the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is January 14th, and we will be having a joint hearing. I'll turn it over to with the House Committee on Energy and Environment. I'll turn it over to co-chair of the meeting, or the chair of the meeting, actually.
Yes. And I'm opening the hearing for the House Interim Energy and Environment Committee. Today is still January 14th, 2016. We are going to start off today with several informational meetings. As you can see, it's standing room only in here, so we will be live streaming this hearing in the Galleria for those of you who weren't able to find a seat. You can find that. And we're starting a little bit past the hour, so let's go ahead and get started. The first informational hearing will be a overview of the renewable portfolio standards. So we're going to go ahead and bring those up. So I'll open that hearing. And we're going to have Kristen Sheeran, Varner Seaman, Scott Bolton, and Bob Jenks. If you come up to the front, please. Welcome, everyone. Kristen, I think we're starting with you.
Okay, great.
Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you for inviting us. Chair Vega Peterson, Chair Edwards, and members of the committee. My name is Kristen Sheeran, and I'm the Oregon Director for Climate Solutions. We're a regional nonprofit working to accelerate practical and profitable solutions to climate change. Climate Solutions strongly supports the transition from coal and other fossil fuels to clean renewable energy as essential to achieving Oregon's legislated greenhouse gas reduction goals and safeguarding the health and well-being of all Oregonians. Climate Solutions is also one of the founding members of Renew Oregon, a large and diverse and growing coalition, which now consists of more than 160 businesses, nonprofits, faith and community organizations working to create a clean energy economy here in Oregon. Last fall, as many of you know, Renew Oregon filed ballot initiatives to move Oregon off coal towards clean energy. This was in response to very strong public demand to rid our energy supply of coal, to grow the clean energy economy, and to address the urgency of our climate crisis. A related effort to pass a coal to clean energy transition bill in the legislature last year had proven unsuccessful, and so the coalition had decided to bring the issue directly to the public for a vote. In response to these initiatives, PG and Pacific Power reached out in the hope that we could find common ground and avoid a ballot fight. At that point, these utilities, who were those primarily affected by our ballot initiative, as they are the ones with coal in their portfolios, and the organizations who stood behind the ballot initiative, began robust discussions around an alternative policy package. Working together, we were able to develop a legislative proposal both sides could enthusiastically support. It includes a date certain for coal removal, a doubling down on renewable energy generation through our renewable portfolio standard. It includes incentives for electric vehicle infrastructure, access to residential solar for low-income communities, and affirmation of the importance of energy efficiency and demand response programs. Climate Solutions and Renew Oregon support this proposal as the next generation of climate-smart energy policy for Oregon. It accelerates the path to clean energy while protecting ratepayers and creating economic opportunities for our state. It represents the best of what Oregonians can achieve when we work collaboratively around shared goals. The coal that currently powers more than one-third of Oregon homes and businesses accounts for 25% of Oregon's greenhouse gas emissions. So simply put, there is no way for the state to achieve its legislated greenhouse gas reduction goals unless we somehow replace that coal power with clean, renewable energy. So this proposal removes the coal, and it also leaves very little room for new natural gas as our utilities increase their investments in wind, solar, efficiency, and other clean energy resources to achieve a 50% renewable portfolio standard requirement. It allows for an orderly ramp up in renewable energy generation in response to rapidly declining costs for solar and wind and rising costs for coal power. Our proposal positions Oregon at the forefront of the clean energy transition we're experiencing nationwide. Coupled with our existing hydropower capacity in our state, the 50% renewable portfolio standard will make Oregon one of the cleanest energy states in the nation by the year 2040. If passed, this proposal will put Oregon's two largest utilities firmly on the path to meeting their share of Oregon's greenhouse gas reduction goals while reducing risks to ratepayers. In addition, the proposal encourages utilities to invest in the infrastructure Oregon needs to electrify our transportation sector. And it makes residential solar more available to all customers in PGE and Pacific Power service territories, including low-income families, through the creation of community solar programs. This is a comprehensive energy package that can deliver clean, reliable, affordable power to Oregon homes, businesses, and vehicles. It's not often that such a diverse group of stakeholders can agree to a path forward. This proposal and the unique circumstances which created it speaks to the breadth and the strength and support for clean energy and climate protection at this point in time in Oregon. And it speaks to the dedication and cooperation shown by energy industry leaders, utilities, community organizations, and advocates to solving a shared challenge. The transition from coal to clean energy is a critical piece of the climate policy puzzle. Successful resolution of this issue in the legislature, rather than at the ballot next fall, will set an important precedent and prepare Oregon well for the important other next steps we need to take to achieve our greenhouse gas reduction goals. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Vega-Peterson, Chair Edwards, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman here representing Portland General Electric. I want to talk a little bit about the process briefly that we had for negotiating this piece of legislation. As folks are aware, last spring in the 2015 long session, there was a piece of legislation called the Coal to Clean Bill. Both PGE and PacifiCorp opposed that legislation at that time. A large part of our opposition at that point was that we didn't understand or we didn't have awareness of what the final Clean Power Plan or Section 111D of the Clean Air Act federal rule on carbon emissions for existing power plants would be. We were concerned that having state action before we knew what that final rule would be would make it difficult if, for some reason, that state action conflicted with the components of the Clean Power Plan. So in May of 2015, after it was clear that the Coal to Clean proposal was not going to go forward, but that we were going to need to have continuing conversation about carbon on PG and PacifiCorp system, there was a letter that was sent from Scott Bolton at PacifiCorp and Dave Robertson, who's vice president I report to at Portland General Electric, and it was sent to a group of organizations that were part of the discussion to reach the early closure agreement on the Boardman coal-fired facility, where we've agreed to stop burning coal at Boardman at the end of 2020. The rule became final. Clean Power Plan rule became final in August. At that point, we started working to schedule a date with the group of diverse stakeholders around the table, scheduling a meeting. Maybe it was one of the more difficult steps in the process. After a date was agreed to around Halloween, there was the filing of the ballot measures that we discussed. PG and PacifiCorp intended to have conversations about, as we said, Clean Power Plan and carbon. Those discussions took on a different tenor, and the urgency increased once we realized that there were potentially ballot measures coming forward in 2016. What we started to do at that point then is to look across the table at the parties that were gathered and to start to ask the question whether or not we could reach an agreement that in our minds would be an improvement upon the ballot measure, that would work for the proponents of the ballot measure, and that would be a legislative proposal in lieu of. Frankly, we didn't know whether or not we were going to be able to reach an agreement. It was a fairly difficult set of negotiations. At times, it was somewhat contentious. But at the end of the day, we think we were able to come together and to reach a positive agreement. I think one of the things that folks who are legislators who are going to be voting on this package are going to hear is concern about the process. And we've heard already some accusations of backroom deals or other things. We don't think that that's how it went down. We think it was a group of folks that were the two utilities who would be most directly impacted by the ballot measure and the proponents of the ballot measure sitting down to figure out if we could come up with an alternative. And now we're into a public process where it's up to the legislature to decide if the agreement that we came up with through the vetting and the legislative process is good policy for the state going forward. From our standpoint, from PGE's perspective, this is a good agreement going forward. We think that there's more flexibility and that this is a lower cost measure than what the ballot measures would have been. And on the carbon and climate issues, for PGE, we believe, one, that passage of this bill and the enactment of this bill would put Portland General Electric on a path to meet our pro-rata share of Oregon's GHG reduction targets through the life of this bill through 2040. I think Angus Duncan is going to give some representation later today when he testifies about what he thinks the carbon reduction impacts of this measure will be. When we get into the regular session, we're going to be bringing forward some of our analysis on that point. But I think most importantly is we hear from customers that they're not interested in just reducing carbon or reducing carbon in other places. They actually want the energy that they use to be from a cleaner resource mix. We already have an offsets program through the Climate Trust where when we invest in new fossil resources, we buy offsets in other places. Clearly, that wasn't meeting the desires that our customers had. They simply wanted their electricity not to be generated with coal going forward. And we think that meeting that goal, meeting the state's GHG targets, that this is, in our minds, probably the most direct and we think the lowest cost way to go forward in reducing the emissions on our system. So with that, we're pleased to be in front of you today. We support this package and we're look forward to taking your questions. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Vernon. Thank you.
We'll do a little swap here so that there's room. Thank you.
We have to do a little bit of musical chairs for us. Chair Vega-Peterson, Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jenks. I'm the Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We were established by Oregon voters to represent the interests of residential customers of utilities. I strongly believe that this piece of legislation is in the best interest of customers. First, the bill sets out a policy which is supported by customers. Polls, focus groups, utility surveys of customers. I've seen a lot of data, a lot of evidence that customers in Oregon broadly support phasing out use of coal and additional investment into clean energy. That is what makes the ballot measure possible, and that is why the utilities want to find a way to avoid the ballot measure. This compromise generally sets up broad policy goals to phase out coal over the next 20 years in Oregon and to double our commitment to renewable energy over the next 25 years. But the bill allows a specific transition, details, and plans to be developed in integrated resource plans that are worked out under the direction of the Public Utility Commission. And it's that planning process is how we're able to implement this bill in the least cost way possible. Combining the planning process at the PUC with the flexibility under this compromise legislation should result in lower implementation costs. I want to give one example of that with the initiative in this legislation. In the initiative, it would phase out coal plants under a timeline based on the date that the utility has recovered its original investment in the plant. Essentially, this is the expected useful life of the plant that was set many, many years ago. Under the compromise legislation, the coal plants would be generally phased out by 2030, but the timing and schedule of that would be based on least cost planning informed by the Clean Power Plan. And while that sounds like not much of a difference, it may sound like a technical difference. To me, it's a very big difference, and it's a difference that will probably save customers money as we make this transition. Beyond using least cost planning to develop the implementation plans, there are several other essential consumer protections in this legislation. First, while I strongly believe that this is an affordable way to make this transition, I've looked at the projections of natural gas costs that the utilities have in their least cost plans, their projections of carbon regulatory costs, their projections of other regulatory costs on top of a coal from clean air and regional haze and coal ash, and I don't believe that implementing this legislation will have a significant impact on utility rates. However, forecasting costs in 2030, 2035, and 2040 is not an easy thing. It's not an exact science, and all projections are likely to be wrong. Because of that, the bill retains the 4% cost cap that's in the current RPS. And that means that if the rates are, if this causes rates to be 4% higher than they would otherwise be, the PUC can suspend the implementation of law and the utilities would still be in compliance with it. So even if we're wrong on our forecast that this is affordable, there's a protection for customers. The second consumer protection is it would allow the utilities to request that the commission put a pause on implementation if it was clear that reliability issues would arise. Under the liability provision, the commission can order the utilities to take actions to remedy the situation. Generally, the PUC has the power to accept or reject utility proposals, and it has the ability to allow or deny rate recovery. But under this liability section, the commission can order the utility to take very specific acts and spend money on very specific things in order to fix the reliability problem. This is a protection that goes beyond the current RPS. Third, it makes clear that we only invest in renewables after we found all cost-effective energy efficiency. Oregon customers have saved millions and millions of dollars because this region made a commitment to energy efficiency decades ago, and we want to continue that. It retains the basic structure of how we develop resources. I already mentioned least cost planning, which I think is essential. It also maintains competitive procurement through requests for proposals. And those are critically important to make sure that utilities have to be able to test any proposal they make against the market and choose whatever resource is the least cost. Ensures that the renewable energy credits that are generated by the qualifying resources invested into meet this act will all be used for compliance and customers will get the value they paid for. It spreads this transition over 25 years. This is a long timetable. The coal to clean bill that was in the this building last year had a 10-year timetable. 25 years is going to give us much more time, much more ability to plan and execute this, and I believe will lower the cost of this transition. It includes a community solar program that allows Oregonians who do not have south-facing roofs the opportunity to reduce their power bills by investing in solar. When we started these discussions at the end of October, I would have bet against us. The stakeholders did not speak a common language, they did not fully trust each other, and they had very different goals. But we spent a lot of time together. We were forced to actually listen to each other and understand each other's concerns. Rather than a big, expensive, ugly fight over a ballot measure, stakeholders worked to find common solution. In the end, we came up with something that I personally think is better than the initiative, and I say that as somebody who supported the initiative. And I urge you to listen carefully to all the details, as you'll hear about them in the next month or so, and support the bill when it ultimately comes before you for a vote. Thank you, and I'll be happy to help answer questions.
Thank you.
Okay. Scott. Chair Vega Peterson, Chair Edwards, Scott Bolton for Pacific Power. Thanks for the opportunity to appear before you. I'll be brief, just following on to the comments of my fellow panelists. But, as you've heard, this is a pretty significant agreement. Pacific Power supports this agreement. And we believe it's a compromise that seeks to balance the interest of Oregon's desire to move to a cleaner electricity supply while maintaining protections for customers and ensuring Oregon's economic competitiveness. And I agree with Bob. Compared to the ballot initiatives, this does constitute the better plan. For Pacific Power, ultimately we want our business to align with the services that our customers want, while also achieving the policy objectives of the state where our customers reside. That principle is important to how we meet Oregon's energy needs, but it also is important to how we meet the energy needs of the five other states that we serve across the West. We're obligated to align our business with the values and expectations of our customers and the states where we do business. And it's this within this agreement we think this principle is reflected. So just real briefly, there's three key themes, I think, that comes out of this legislation in the LC draft that you'll be reviewing. First, I believe that we've done a pretty good job protecting customers from unreasonable costs. The ballot measures would limit service from coal resources in a much more cumbersome way than this legislation. Under this approach, Pacific Power can serve its customers on an integrated basis using least cost resources until 2030. That's important to how we system plan. That's important to how we have been able to deliver service for decades. But it also gives us a bright line that there is a different expectation 2030 and beyond, and it gives us the time to plan and make the investments and take the measures that we need to do in order to meet that different fuel mix beyond 2030. The flexibility system plan to be able to work not just with our stakeholders in Oregon, but our stakeholders across the West, and having simply the time to transition Oregon's electricity supply is a premium and will be the most cost-effective path.
The ballot measures do not ensure the same flexibility, nor do other policy initiatives so far that we've seen. The second major theme is that it builds upon what already works. So while the goals of this proposal are bold, end coal service to Oregon by 2030 and build up our renewable supply to Oregonians to 50% by 2040, the means with which we do that are actually pretty tried and true. We're building on the framework of Oregon's successful RPS using the same compliance measurements, consumer protections, resource flexibility that we've had in place since 2007. The Public Utility Commission continues to provide robust oversight and rate regulation and will maintain the respectful balance that distinguishes between larger utilities and smaller utilities in the state. The investments and measures that we employ to make this policy work are tangible, they're real, and they have direct benefit to the service that we provide to our customers. The third theme of this legislation is that it ensures the integrity of the grid. As Bob mentioned, the last thing we would do is agree to a proposal that in any way would compromise or risk our ability to provide safe and reliable service to customers. We know, we well know that there are challenges as we increase the amount of intermittent resources in our portfolio and those impacts on the grid. And frankly, we're up to those challenges. We're looking into new technologies, we're exploring new ways of operating our system in order to make that work and make it work effectively for our customers. But if we do experience problems, if we do run into difficulties in maintaining excellent reliability and affordability of the grid, as Bob mentioned, we do have specific provisions within this legislation to be able to address reliability. Additional provisions in the bill relating to community solar and electric vehicle charging, frankly, are responsive to customers who are demanding these services and expect their utilities to provide more leadership in these areas. And, of course, remember, these programs will continue to be regulated and have the oversight of the Public Utility Commission and must ensure that there's some benefit to customers as we pursue different programs. You'll have the opportunity to dig further into this legislation and come to your own judgment on its merits, but I could say that I would not be here in support of this legislation, nor would my company allow me to be here if we didn't believe that we could do this in a workable, affordable way. Thank you.
Thank you. Do we have questions? Representative Betts.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for all the hard work on this really interesting piece of legislation. I've got several questions, but the first one is, where is the PUC on this? What are they thinking?
Madam Chair, Representative Benz, I don't know. To be honest, I think that's one of the things we in trying to put the bill together, we put together a bill. It was an alternative to the ballot measure, and we encourage people to think of it in that context and have released it now. We're still trying to get language out of Ledge Council, and this is a process where I think we'll start to have a review of it. I hope they get language and are able to start to run some numbers and themselves do their own analysis of the impacts of this, and we'll see where that follows up.
And the LC number is LC42, and it actually is available on OLDIS now for those of you looking for it.
42? Follow up. So what you're saying is we don't know where the PUC is yet. That's what you're saying. And I'm okay with that.
I'm not sure that they've had time to do the analysis. And again, the PUC specializes in analysis, I just don't know.
One thing that I learned in working on the low carbon fuel standard was that some of these iconic things like the RPS have an attractiveness that overwhelms perhaps the actual productive element of the idea, and that's what I see here, although I'm not an expert like you guys are. But it appears to me that, on my take of it, two things, it's three, it's long on symbolism, it's short on impact, and I think it's going to be really expensive. Symbolism because, of course, it's the RPS. Impact, because you can correct me, but I don't think any less coal is burned as a result of this. My understanding is that you'll keep on burning coal, and you'll contract that somehow none of that which is being burned is coming here. From an engineering standpoint, I don't understand that. I'm not an engineer. But that's what I see happening. You can correct me. And then the last part, expensive. I had the great good fortune to work on some of these things years ago, and have the faintest understanding of residential slash irrigation and how that reimbursement occurs between the Bonneville Power folk on the one hand and IOUs on the other. And it strikes me that that plus other things that are quite complex having to do with depreciation and investment and reliability and backup, there's a lot of money there. And to point at the 4%, I'm not so sure that that's the saving device for this. What I've learned in the day I've had to look at this is that it is one complex thing and subject to a lot of rhetorical flourishes, which I think I've heard some of. So I'll be studying it more. And if you want to comment on anything that I've said, yay. But I'm looking forward to some further conversation about this interesting piece of legislation. From my standpoint, what I see here is much higher ratepayer bills. And I mean much higher. And so when you come in to see me, if you do, I'd sure like to see the facts that suggest otherwise. And of course, I have a bill, oddly enough, that is called the Climate Metrics Bill. And it would impose upon the DEQ the obligation to measure the consequences of legislation of this nature. And if it was in place, perhaps that would answer some of our questions, but it's not yet. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I suspect that, Bob, you're the best person to answer this, but I'll take whatever answer I can get. This issue of the ability of the PUC to hit the pause button, I have not been able to read the draft yet, but what I think I hear is that that's a pretty open-ended process. In other words, they can hit the pause button, but there's nothing in the legislation that would say how long. And we can agree to be reasonable here, but when everybody's lawyers get involved, they'll exploit an open-ended provision like that, and we could end up having a pause for a lot longer than we expect now as we're looking at this. So I'm concerned about safeguards against that and would love your insights.
Madam Chair, Representative Helm, I think that's a good question. I think the first thing is the reliability provision is an open-ended pause, but it very clearly says that during that time the commission has to be making the utility solve the reliability problem and get back on with the bill. So there's a temporary timeout to deal with whatever it is that creates the reliability problem, but then they have to get back on it and have to get back on the bill, and they have to do a plan to get back onto a reliable system where they can comply with the law, and the utility can order them to the commission can order them to take actions to do it. So if the utility is dragging its feet in order to avoid compliance with the law, the commission has the power to order the utility to take the actions that would be necessary to get to solve the reliability problem and get back into compliance with the law. And quite frankly, I believe I practiced before the Public Utility Commission for more than 20 years, and in good faith they will execute this. I've never seen the commission not act in good faith. Lawyers can delay things and mess things up a little bit, but not too much. They're a pretty efficient agency. So I have complete faith that the commission can implement that, and that provision will not undermine the law. That provision, I believe, will protect us from something happening that threatens reliability.
Yeah. Maybe a follow-on to that, Representative. First, I don't know of occasion where we've really dragged our feet on anything, especially a reliability issue, but the level of system impact where we would have a reliability issue, where we would go to the commission and say, fulfillment of this public policy jeopardizes the integrity of the electric system, is a really, really big deal. We have national reliability standards. We have regional reliability standards. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has, in recent years, has really stepped up its enforcement of these types of measures, where we can face fines of going up to hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars a day if there is a serious enough problem. So we are highly motivated that if we're seeing something, if there is a conflict between meeting Oregon's policy goals and being able to run a safe and reliable grid as a result of that, that we do flag that up to every authority that we possibly can, but we also have an obligation to fix the problem and make sure that whatever is, you know, creating a reliability issue or a potential event, that that's being addressed aggressively.
Thank you. I appreciate the answer. I'll be asking it again when we get on the official record.
Thank you. Senator
Denver. Thanks, Madam Chair. I have two questions, if I could. The first one is, it's kind of related to what Representative Benz asked. Scott, I remember a couple of years ago we talked about this concept, and at that time, as I think Varner mentioned, things were still very much in flux with the Clean Power Plan. And you know, and there was concern about how this kind of program would interface with that, since it was still in flux. So I wonder if you could say something more specific about how this coheres with that plan, and maybe more specifically, how we will be interfacing with those other states where the coal is being burned. What will happen to those power plants?
That's a great question, Senator. There's still a lot that we don't know, but we know more than we did. States have not yet written and submitted and had approved their state implementation plans under the Clean Power Plan or 111D of the EPA Clean Air Act rule. But I'll tell you what this does do. What this does do is it allows the space for the Clean Power Plan to be fully implemented. It gives us the ability to know on a state-by-state basis, especially those states that do have coal plants, what their implementation plans will reveal, how they are going to tackle compliance, and how we're going to be able to continue to evaluate what are the most cost-effective resources. I mean, we are not ideologues. We don't prefer one type of energy generation over the other. These are all machines to us. We need to stitch together the most efficient system that we can to deliver a product as efficiently and as affordably as possible. So as the Clean Power Plan does become more mature, as we do move into meeting state compliance plans, we'll be able to evaluate how much longer machines in different states will be able to continue running and what additional machines we will need to make up those resources. And that's one of the elegance, I think, of this particular proposal, is we're looking at not just the renewable portfolio standard as the tool or the 2030 date as the tool, but looking at how these dates align, because around this time is when we do predict that we are going to need replacement resources. And the RPS, which has been in effect since 2007, which has been faithfully implemented and has been successful as far as being a cost-effective public policy, simply is a procurement standard. It just says that we have to look at renewables first before we look at other energy generation resources to serve customers. And as Bob mentioned, if it's, you know, if the costs of renewables are that out of alignment, if they're that much more expensive than our next best choice, then we won't do that. We will always try to seek the least cost solution. I don't know how. I'm sure I'll get better by the time we get to February and you ask that question again. But there is an alignment with the timing here that makes sense with the Clean Power Plan and what Oregon's seeking to do here. And that alignment has a lot of value. Mm-hmm.
So presumably, if I could follow up to that, you're going to get to the point where you're going to have to make decisions on individual power plants. And those decisions are going to be informed by a number of different issues. And one of them most likely would be the RPSs that are there in the states that your customers are living in. But wouldn't that be true? So what we're doing here will at some point help to inform the decision that's made when you're looking at least cost delivery of resource.
That's fair.
Okay. Now I have another question, and this has to do, thank you, with one of, I think, you know, another attractive feature of this program is one that has to do with electric vehicle charging. It's a, you know, exciting area for investment. And I'm One of the reasons that I'm really attracted to seeing more electric vehicles is its effect on the public health, right? These are no-emission vehicles. We have a lot of people, particularly low-income people, people of color, who are, for economic reasons, that they live near highways. And the more that we can clean up the air around where they live, the better for them. And I'm wondering to what extent those kinds of criteria, you know, criteria of public health, of public good, will go into effect when decisions are made as to where do we locate this infrastructure, where do we put this infrastructure. So I wonder if that's, if you could help me with how that will work.
Yes, Senator, that actually will be a consideration. Where you have air emissions non-attainment areas, there are certain airsheds in Oregon that do struggle to meet their EPA standards for vehicle emissions. There probably will be a focus on addressing those issues and trying to direct infrastructure into those areas. So a good example for us would be the Rogue Valley, where they do have different times of the year some significant air issues, and to the extent that having a greater penetration of electric vehicles assists with that and can create more opportunity for other industries and other economic activity in the Rogue Valley, I do think this would be part of the solution.
Probably.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you tell me how this would affect the rural electric co-ops and what they're thinking along these lines for this bill? Any of you.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Representative Boone, I'm not sure I can tell you what they're thinking. They're pretty good about expressing how they feel about things as it is. What I would say is that the ballot measure would have impacted every utility in the state that has an RPS obligation, because it did change how renewable energy credits are accounted for and in what we call banking for compliance. So changing the lifespan or the compliance life of RECs, which the ballot measures contemplate, would impact the compliance strategy for every utility, whether you're a large electric utility or you're a smaller consumer-owned utility. What this agreement does is it really focuses policy change on the state's two largest investor-owned utilities, and does not have any impact on the compliance, the current compliance or the current requirements under the RPS for small co-ops, people's utility districts, and municipal utilities.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Bolton, I had asked one of your employees this question to make sure that you were aware of it, to make sure you had the answer for it. What is your guaranteed rate of return on your investments?
Our rate of return is our return on equity that is set for our rate base.
And what is the what's the number you can go to?
9.8 right now.
So you can go up to 9.8% return on your investment. And what portion, what percentage of your company and your residential users buy into your program to use only renewable?
So we do have a voluntary renewable program. It's called the Blue Sky Program for Pacific Power. This is effectively where customers pay a little bit extra on their bill to pay into Greenies certified programs. In Oregon, I believe our Blue Sky participation is about 9.5% of our customer base.
9.5%.
And I just amend that. It's not just residential customers who participate. We have small and medium businesses and some large industrials that participate in that program, too.
Follow-up question? If I'm not, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but 70% of the electricity in our state is provided by PG and PacifiCorp. Is that about correct?
That's about correct.
So the question then is, as these costs are incurred, which they will be, and rates will go up, how do you justify the impact to those 70% that have to pay it, compared to those 30% that don't have to pay it, giving them an economic advantage over electricity, over energy?
Senator, do you mean customers of investor-owned utilities versus those non?
Right.
Yeah. Well, what I would say, Senator and committee members, is that resources get replaced all the time. We have new resources that come in, either through contracts or, again, machines that we build and put into service. And then those contracts either end or those machines get old and need to be replaced. That is the constant utility investment cycle. It's been that way since the early 1900s for my company. And so the idea here is to try to line up when we know that we will be building or buying power in the marketplace to replace and transition a portfolio that is going to have to transition anyhow. So I wouldn't look at this in terms of this is all additive and this is all new cost. We will experience new costs as we replace old power plants. We will have to acquire power from either our own new power plants or from contracts from other providers. That's just what our future looks like.
I think you misunderstood my question. 70% of the state is going to pay higher rates because of this program. The other 30% will not pay higher rates because of this program, giving an economic advantage to that 30% that doesn't have an energy increase.
Well, I guess my response to that is that it's absolutely not in my interest as a representative of my company to want to see anybody else having an economic advantage. Our approach to this is to continue to try to compete and make sure that the communities that we serve are just as affordable and cost competitive as anywhere else in the state. Obviously, we have a huge disparity in the Pacific Northwest between those utilities that, through act of Congress, receive their preference power supply from the federal government and those that don't. Investor-owned utilities have to invest in their systems and build generation through the investment of private capital. That's a fundamental difference in business models that exist here today. We wouldn't be here supporting this if we thought that this would create such an economic disincentive to doing business in our communities that it would create more incentive to go to be served by another utility or another part of the state or even another state.
Representative Burden.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, first of all, everyone that was involved for your hard work on this. It's never easy to do that, and I like it because it really seems and feels like kind of the Oregon way of challenging hard tasks. So I also comment that I'm very comfortable with the RPS process. It's something we've been using for years, and there's a good balance of pressures that are involved. So what I'm interested in, though, is question. The easy part of the question is, could you comment on how this will either help with economic growth in the state of Oregon or be a drag on economic growth? And then maybe possibly harder part of that question for you, Scott, is we're going to have ratepayers here buying the electricity. The coal plants that you're swapping out are off in another state somewhere. When you replace those, where's the investment going to be made?
So thank you, Representative Reardon. Maybe to take your last part of that question first. Again, one of the principles of the legislation, the agreement, was to really build on what we already have. And one of the, I think, one of the hallmarks of Oregon's RPS that is, frankly, a lot better than other renewable standards that we've seen or experienced across the country is that it is fairly geographically neutral. So it does, it's really focused on least cost and least risk. And so to the extent that it makes sense to build power plants in Oregon, that's happened. And both Portland General Electric and Pacific Power have invested in wind farms and solar here in Oregon. But where there's also been additional opportunities for other quality resources, so such as eastern Wyoming and kind of the Sun Belt of southern Utah, those have been eligible to meet Oregon's renewable standard as well. And it takes advantage, frankly, of a real gift that we have, which is probably the least interesting thing that most customers or most people think about, but it's a very robust transmission system that serves our company and serves the region. And so being able to have geographic diversity and technology diversity, so whether it's solar or wind or geothermal or biomass, to be able to tap those different technologies and have a real diversity of machines, again, that you can put into the system to serve customers, that has been really the legacy and the benefit of the RPS so far, is that we've been able to always choose the best fit for what we've needed, both from a cost standpoint and from what is reliable within our system.
Okay.
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Reardon. I think one of the questions that people are going to be talking about, I think part of what Representative Helms' question was around the reliability piece. And I think one of the things that people ask about is, well, if we're moving to having 50% being variable resources, weather-dependent resources, how do you make sure that you can keep the lights on? And I think, as Scott was alluding to, resource diversity, geographic diversity of these resources is going to be pretty important. So we're going to have to look at not having them all located in the same place for the resources that we're acquiring. And I think a lot of the resource planning is going to be making sure that we've got that diversity of resources so that we can get a more consistent output from those, from the generation that's brought online.
We'll have a public hearing on this in February. Yes. Okay, we have time for one more question. So Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I probably have 100 questions. Hopefully, I will be able to answer some of those by reading through the draft that we received about 30 minutes before this session. My understanding, as of midday yesterday, the Public Utility Commission had never seen a draft of this either, so I suppose their analysis is also lacking. My first question, and Mr. Bolton, you alluded to this earlier, but I want to put it on the record. Were the Public Utility Commission, the Department of Energy, the Governor's Office, any legislative office, the LFO, LRO, or the Legislative Administration, or the industrial or commercial power users included in your negotiations?
You want me to take that? I'll keep going. Senator Whitsitt. No, I mean, as Varner discussed, the original discussion was really the corners of the two sides lining up armies around ballot measures.
The second question, if I might, is that we've all seen analyses of the coming bill, the coming draft. Can you identify anything in this draft that we received about half an hour ago that is a major addition or subtraction to the analyses that we have seen before?
I'm not familiar with the analysis, Senator.
Chair Baker Peterson, Senator Whitsitt. There have been some summaries that have been sent out. I think that folks have been working to, as we discussed in terms of the timeline, the ballot measures were filed in early October. We had a couple of pretty intense months of negotiation with some significant holidays in between, and we're trying to get the materials caught up. I think we've made what I believe is a good faith effort to make sure that the materials that have been provided to folks over the last couple days are accurate. We want to make sure that we have some process for folks to evaluate and for the legislators to be reviewing this bill. We believe that what we've provided is complete and a full summary of this, but we want to make sure that people do have the chance to review the bill, and we're happy to discuss it further.
Follow-up.
The other question I have is that there's, from the analyses that I've seen, there is what I would call a poison pill for consumer-owned utilities, in which, as it's been explained to me, if a consumer-owned utility takes as many as one customers from your service area by expansion or creating a new PUD or MUD, then that this bill would require that consumer-owned utility to meet the full requirements of then-enforced renewable portfolio standard. other than protecting the monopoly of the investor-owned utility, what is the purpose for that?
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, that's the current law now, is that principle that that every utility in Oregon has a renewable obligation under the RPS, going back to 2007. Small utilities have a smaller obligation. Large utilities have a larger obligation. Part of the balance that was achieved in 2007 was to, in recognizing that some utilities had a lighter lift, didn't have to do as much as larger utilities, was to not promote what I would describe as utility-on-utility violence, where there would be competition for customers because of any real or perceived disparities that would occur because of the public policy. All this does is continue that principle that has been in law since 2007.
I would vehemently disagree with that, your characterization. It's my understanding that if a currently a public utility district or MUD can file for your area and for to encroach in your area and use eminent domain to acquire your assets, and that the PUD, as if it didn't reach a higher level of more than 3% of the statewide utilization, would not be subject to this draconian increase in the renewable portfolio standard that would apply to them. This one appears to apply to them if they take as much as a single customer. So maybe I don't understand it. We haven't had time to read it, but as it's been explained to me, it would certainly ensure that no one ever encroaches on your area.
Well, what I would say, Senator, is that nothing in this legislation changes the home rule authority and constitutional power of a municipal entity to become an electric utility, should that be the will of the voters in that city, or the statute that governs people's utility districts and their formations. What this does do is just simply update for a higher RPS. So under current statute now, if there was a eminent domain, basically a property taking action to acquire service territory through the formation or through an existing utility that isn't in the large utility category, they themselves would be in the large utility category. That's the law now. The large utility category, effectively, through this legislation, has grown. It's grown from a 25% renewable target by 2025 to now a 50%. So this carries that forward without a doubt. That's a bigger target than is existing law today. But that principle and that framework has been in place for quite some time.
Thank you all very much for all your work in bringing this forward. We are going to be having a hearing in the House Energy and Environment Committee the first week of February on this bill, where we'll hear from, I'm sure we'll see your faces again, as well as other stakeholders who want to testify on this, and then we'll have more time for questions on that. And before you go, I just wanted to take a minute to thank Mark Mayer, who drafted this bill, who did yeoman's work in getting this together so that we did have the language to look at for today's hearing. So thank you. And
Chair Big Peterson, members of the committee, we also appreciate Mark's work and timely turning this around. We think it was some difficult drafting. We really do appreciate him, so thank you.
Okay, thanks, Varner.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I ask you a procedural question?
Yes.
How do you envision the pathway of this bill through the legislative process? You articulated that you're going to have a hearing on the House side.
Yeah.
Will this bill be referred to Ways and Means? And if so, will it continue? Will it not then have a hearing in the Senate side?
So that is obviously ultimately up for the Speaker. This is going to be a House Energy and Environment bill, so I'm expecting it will start here, and where the path goes from there, I'm not sure yet.
So there is no assurance that there will be a hearing in the Senate on this?
I expect there would be if that's where the path takes, so we can follow up more on that. Okay? All right, thank you. So the next we're going to hear from is our very own Senator Edwards on the Healthy Climate Legislative Concept 48, which is also on OLIS, as well as Maureen McKee.
I can't show stuff.
So, there aren't any plans.
I don't know why it would go there.
Yeah, oh, there aren't any plans to do that, but I haven't even talked about that. But, so, it's, I mean, there's no plans to do that.
These are not.
Yeah, I mean.
I just got out long enough.
No.
Oh.
I think we're on short sessions.
Yeah, so, but no. We haven't. There hasn't been on short sessions.
Yeah.
Can't hear you mumbling. You know, the community.
Yeah. Catch her.
She's getting old.
All right. Senator, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chris Edwards, State Senator representing Eugene and Junction City in the Oregon Senate. I'm here to present LC 48, which is the Healthy Climate Act of 2016. I thought procedurally, if it pleases the Chair, what we might do is I have a three-page summary of the bill that I'll walk through, full of typos and syntax errors. So you're just going to have to bear with me. It's the ideas. It's not the bill. It's not the bill language. It's the ideas on the page that matter. Okay. It's full of those errors because it's produced by myself. And I asked staff to print it out as I was running down here, and it still says draft on it. So, and then I thought after we walk through the three-page summary of conceptually what the program does, what the Healthy Climate Act does, Maureen McKee, the drafter of the bill from Legislative Council, is here and could walk us through the sections of the bill and the actual bill language. So if that sounds okay with the Chair, that's how we'll proceed.
That sounds excellent.
Okay, so a little bit of background information. We all understand the issue of climate change. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. I did want to note, though, and I think it's of great significance, that the United States has a really big role to play. If we are to tackle the issue of global climate change. China is the largest gross emitter of greenhouse gas emissions in the world on a gross basis, but on a per capita basis, the United States is almost double the greenhouse gas emissions per capita as China. Interestingly, not number one, but almost double what China is. The nation of Qatar has the dubious distinction of being the number one greenhouse gas emission emitter per capita. But I digress. The purpose of this bill is to make sure that Oregon is put on a path to meeting its greenhouse gas reduction goals as enumerated in the bill and as it enumerated in previous law. We've all seen presentations of how that might be done through a cap on emissions and that contain flexible compliance mechanisms. And this bill, in fact, establishes that through a cap and invest approach. It would cap greenhouse gas emissions through the auction of allowances by the state to emitting entities. The proceeds of the sale of those allowances would be invested in utility bill rate relief, greenhouse gas reduction efforts, and community and economic adaptation and resilience measures. Let's first take a look at the three big buckets of greenhouse gas emissions in the state of Oregon and how each of them are treated in this bill. First, we have the transportation fuel sector, which accounts for about 37% of greenhouse gas emissions in the state. Next, we have electric power generation, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of 32% of greenhouse gas emissions in the state. And then we have industrial emissions, which comprises about 19%. So each of these sectors is treated a little bit differently in this bill. Transportation fuels, as we know, we have the Clean Fuels Program here in the state of Oregon, I want to make clear that this bill specifically says that the department may not bring transportation fuels into the CAP program until the 10-year goals of the clean fuels program are realized. At that point, the department could bring them into the program, and it is expected that they would. Funds generated from the sale of credits to the transportation fuel sector would be invested in transportation projects that further the purposes of the bill, which is adaptation and resilience and greenhouse gas reduction. Those would be transportation projects that further those purposes. 20% of the projects must be located within disadvantaged communities. 20% of projects must otherwise benefit disadvantaged communities. And preference would be given to projects that have the greatest greenhouse gas reduction benefits. So that's the overview of what the transportation fuel sector program would look like. The electric power generation and natural gas utilities, for them, proceeds of the sale of allowances would go for three, not two purposes. There's typo number one. They would be used for rate relief for low-income residential customers, rate relief for energy-intensive industries, and residential or small business climate credits. And then finally, in the industrial emissions sector, we have set a threshold of regulation at 25,000 metric tons of emissions annually. And that is a defined list. Those sources of emissions already report through the DEQ program. If you don't have that information, the DEQ can get you that information about exactly who it is that would be affected by the bill as of 2014. Accommodations and exemptions and or exemptions for energy intensive, trade sensitive, or industrial entities for whom it is technologically unfeasible to comply would be required by the department in order to prevent leakage of emissions out of Oregon into other jurisdictions. It doesn't do us any good to put a cap that can't be, just like, for whatever reason, a specific industry can't comply, and they close the doors here, and then they go across the border to the state of Idaho, and then they set up shop there. There's no benefit to the environment for that, and there's certainly no benefit to Oregon's economy. So we have a provision in the bill for that. Proceeds from the sale of allowances would go, for 85% of the allowances would go to the Climate Investments Fund for purposes of adaptation, resilience, and greenhouse gas reduction. So that's a fund that really is one of the exciting parts of this bill, in that it creates opportunities not only to further greenhouse gas reduction efforts, but also to focus a bit on a conversation that I think we haven't been focused on enough in the climate change debate, and that is, what are we going to do for adaptation? We know that action is urgent now if we are to stave off the worst effects of global climate change. But nonetheless, we need to be preparing ourselves. I mean, you know, increased incidence and severity of drought and increased incidence and severity of wildfire are things that we need to address. And I know in my 5 years on the Ways and Means Committee here in this Capitol, we continually were stressed for trying to figure out ways to address these issues. The funds that are created by the sale of allowances would be required to be spent in with a couple of caveats. 40% would have to be spent in economically distressed areas. That is defined in statute currently. I haven't discussed this with legislative council yet, but I think there may if that definition isn't the right definition, the definition that's in statute, then we may need to work on that a bit. The idea is that rural communities, natural resource dependent communities, need a source of funds to do things like water infrastructure, to be able to invest in water storage and irrigation upgrades. There are a lot of opportunities there. 40% of the funds must be spent in disadvantaged communities. And then there's a governance committee structure and membership, which is yet to be determined. There are a lot of opinions about who should advise and who should control that pot of funds. And I didn't really want to get too specific about that until we had a chance to engage the larger legislature. So there is language in the bill, but it's considered to be placeholder language for that. And then 15% of the funds would go to the Just Transition Funds. The purpose of the Just Transition Fund is to support economic diversification, job creation, job training, and other employment and mental health services for workers and communities in this state that are adversely impacted by climate change or climate change policies. It is my view that as we embark on the long path to economic transition, to dealing with climate change, and instituting these measures for adaptation and resilience, that it is possible that some folks could be adversely impacted. And if you're a worker and you're 60 years old and you lose your job because of a policy like this, we need to have some sort of a way to keep you whole. So the idea is that there'd be the Just Transition Fund to help with those type of efforts. Overall, this bill creates a number of investment opportunities. I mentioned water storage and irrigation upgrades, wildfire prevention resources, support for forest collaborative efforts for landscape level treatments on federal forest land to reduce the likelihood of wildfire. And yes, wildfire is a significant source of greenhouse gas emissions in the state of Oregon. And I think that we have not recognized that enough in our deliberations here in this capital. Energy efficiency, private sector, greenhouse gas reduction grants and financing, all of these are opportunities that would be created by this bill. The bill allows the EQC to pursue linkage with other markets. We all know that the state of California has a big program there. The bill does not require the department or the commission to pursue the linkage agreement. The bill allows offsets, but it also establishes standards for offsets. The offsets must be additional in their greenhouse gas reduction or sequestration. They must be quantifiable, they must be permanent and verifiable. The use of offsets is limited to 8% in the state of California. In the current draft of this legislation, the DEQ may limit the use of offsets, but is not required to limit the use of offsets. And finally, the timeline that I'd like to talk about, and I think it's really important to this discussion because it speaks to why we're taking it up in a short legislative session. It is critical in developing the rules of a program like this that the department and the administrative branch have adequate time to convene stakeholders and really get down in the weeds on it. That takes time, and if they were to convene in the spring of this year, they could be ready for the 2019 legislative session so that we would have a chance to see what it is that we are authorizing them to do in this bill, and then have a chance to intervene and or make adjustments to the program. I mean, they may be coming back and saying, look, we have broad agreement that we'd like to change the program in this way, but you boxed us in with too much specificity in the original statute, and so we need some more authority. And that would give us the 2019 legislative session to be able to take that up for implementation then in 2020. If we don't get going by 2020, the possibility or the likelihood of hitting those goals becomes more and more difficult. We already know that we're not going to hit our 2020 goal. It's probably not feasible. So we've established in the bill a 2025 goal, a 2035 limit, and a 2050 limit. So I believe that the advantages provided by this approach are that in creating a cap with a market, we are going to have the ability to find the lowest cost avenues for compliance and meeting our greenhouse gas reduction goals. And I believe that, you know, currently we spend a lot of money that flows out of state, and that money will be retained for in-state investments. Now, a lot of that money will be retained in-state. When we cap emissions, sale of allowances, the money from that goes back into the state of Oregon, into critical infrastructure, and to funding the greenhouse gas reduction efforts and technologies that are really going to take us into the future and help the economy as a whole transition. So, Madam Chair, that's the overview of what the program does. And we can either walk through the bill now or we can take questions. Perhaps we should walk through the bill and then get into specific questions.
Yeah, I suspect that some questions may be answered as we walk through the bill. So let's go ahead and walk through the bill, and then we'll go.
Thank you, Chair Vega Peterson. Thank you, Chair Edwards, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Maureen McGee. I'm a deputy in Legislative Council, and Chair Edwards asked me to come here today to walk through the provisions of LC Draft 48. Chair Edwards already gave a very detailed summary of the bill, in fact, so I believe that the best way I can fulfill my role at this point is to essentially match up the summary that he gave with the specific sections of the bill, and that way, as you move forward in your deliberations, you'll have a little bit better understanding of how this all pieces together. So just going right from the beginning, Section 1 of the bill states that this act shall be known and may be cited as the Healthy Climate Act of 2016. Sections 2 through 4 of the draft deal with statewide greenhouse gas emission limits. Now, what these sections do is repeal the current provision we have on the books for statewide greenhouse gas emissions goals, and it replaces that provision with one that sets a new goal for the year 2025 to limit greenhouse gas emissions to levels that are at least 20% below 1990 levels. And then for the years 2035 and 2050, sets legally enforceable statewide greenhouse gas emission limits. Sections 5 through 17 of the bill are the greenhouse gas cap and investment program that Senator Edwards explained to you in his summary. Section 6 states the purpose of the greenhouse gas cap and investment program as reducing greenhouse gas emissions consistent with the statewide greenhouse gas emission limits that are established under that new Section 4, and to promote the adaptation and resilience by the state's communities and economy in the face of climate change. Section 7 requires that in adopting provisions related to the actual carbon pollution market, which I'll speak about a little bit later, the Environmental Quality Commission shall consult with a number of different state agencies, Indian tribes, federal agencies, and also be advised by an advisory committee appointed by the governor, and the provisions for who would be members of that advisory committee in this draft are broad. Section 8 provides the definitions for the cap and investment program, and as I move through the rest of the bill, I can jump back to Section 8 if it's necessary to your understanding of certain defined terms. Section 9 is where we really get into the meat of the requirements for Environmental Quality Commission to adopt a carbon pollution market by rule. The section requires the Environmental Quality Commission, first and foremost, to identify the sources who will be subject to the carbon pollution market. But as Senator Edwards stated, there are some restrictions on that. And you'll see in Section 9, Sub 1A, and this is on page 9 of the bill, that the EQC may not require sources that are also subject to the low carb or sources that are subject to the low carbon fuel standards to also be subject to this cap until the goal of the low carbon fuel standards have been met. So that's where that appears in the bill. And then on lines 22 through 25 in page 9, that's where you see the threshold of 25,000 annual metric tons of carbon dioxide emissions as the threshold for regulation. And that's verified annual emissions as based on reporting that will be made, reporting that is already done to the Department of Environmental Quality. The rest of Section 9 essentially requires the Commission to set up a carbon pollution market that follows the basic principles for cap and trade programs that have been adopted or proposed in other jurisdictions. And that includes the annual declining cap on the amount of allowances that will be distributed through the market, the requirements for entities to hold and later surrender to the department their allowances in order to meet compliance obligations. The two parts that I wanted to specifically point out are on page 10, line 2, is where the provisions for the distribution of allowances begin. And those provisions require that a certain amount of the allowances are going to be set aside in a price containment reserve to help with cost containment. Then it goes on to talk about the distribution to electric utilities and natural gas utilities, which allows for the allowances that are distributed to those utilities to later be consigned back to the auction marketplace, and the monies from the sale of those allowances is the money that is going to go to the rate relief that Senator Edwards spoke of. And those rate relief provisions are in Section 12 of the bill. There is a requirement in Section 12 that the Public Utility Commission would do rulemaking to further spell out how that rate relief would work. Then the provisions for leakage that have already been talked about are on page 10, lines 15 through 18. Leakage is a defined term in the bill as well. And then the provisions, and then it requires that all of the remaining allowances will go to the auction holding account to be auctioned by the Department of Environmental Quality. This also is where you will see the provisions for offset projects, and that's going to be subsection 1D, which is begins on line 22, page 10. Moving on to section 10 of the bill, this is the section that lays out further details for how the auction of allowances is going to work. And I won't go through all the details of that except to point out on page 13 of the bill, we're still in section 10, sub 3, the requirements for how the proceeds of the auction are going to be administered. And so just to repeat what you've already heard, but now you can see it in the bill, the auction proceeds from allowances consigned to utilities will again go back to the utilities for rate relief. That's subsection 3A. Subsection 3B is the requirement that proceeds that would constitute revenues required by the Oregon Constitution to go to the highway fund will go to an account within the highway fund, and that's a new account that's being established by this bill, and that account has some of the additional provisions that Senator Edwards discussed for how monies in that account would be distributed. Auction, and then for the remaining proceeds, 85% goes into that Oregon Climate Investments Fund and 15% into the Just Transition Fund. fund. Section 11 of the bill is the section that lays out the specific requirements for how entities are going to meet their compliance obligations at the end of each compliance period. The compliance period is the time when entities are required to actually surrender their combination of allowances or offsets necessary to stack up to the amount of emissions that verified emissions that they've emitted during that compliance period. So that is essentially the carbon pollution market piece of the bill. And again, this cap and investment program really has two pieces. It's the carbon pollution market, and then how are we going to invest the monies coming into the state pursuant to the operation of the carbon pollution market. So the climate investments piece is what's contained in sections 12 through 17. I've already mentioned section 12 about twice now. That's the one for monies coming from allowances for utilities. Section 13 is where we see the climate investments account within the state highway fund, and the provisions that monies in that climate investments account are going to be distributed under a few different restrictions. First, because it's in the highway fund, it can only be used for projects that would otherwise be admissible uses of highway fund money. On top of that, the money would have to be used for purpose for actions that further the purposes of this program. And then on top of that, of the monies in the account, at least 20% would need to be used for projects geographically located in disadvantaged communities and 20% for projects that otherwise benefit the disadvantaged communities. And there would be an advisory committee working with the Department of Transportation in order to distribute those monies. Section 14 of the bill is where we see the Oregon Climate Investments Fund. This is the fund that all of the other monies go into, and this is appropriated to the Department of Environmental Quality. The Department of Environmental Quality will then be charged with distributing those funds through a climate investments grant program, which will be adopted by rule by the Environmental Quality Commission under Section 15 of the bill. And again, as the Senator stated, the Environmental Quality Commission will work with a grant committee. There will be a grant committee that reviews grant applications and makes determinations of funding. The adoption of that grant program will also be subject to advice from a rules advisory committee. Section 16 is the provision for establishing the Just Transition Fund, and that again is where those 15% of certain auction proceeds go in order to support certain activities related to a just transition. And Section 17 provides that it will be the Oregon Business Development Department who runs that grant program. It specifically states a purpose for the program to support economic diversification, job creation, job training, and other employment and mental health services for workers and communities adversely affected by climate change or climate change policies. And again, the Business Development Department would also need to appoint a grant committee for the distribution of those funds.
Excuse me, could you explain what the Just Transition is? It's a fund, but I know that, but what is the Just Transition?
Just Transition is, it's the name of the fund. And perhaps Senator Edwards could best explain the concept behind the Just Transition. It relates to the purpose of the fund, which is to support economic diversification, job training, and employment services for workers who may be disadvantaged by the policy choices of the state in order to address climate change.
It's a pretty good summary. Step it up. That's what it is.
Yeah. And that's really the meat of the bill. The remainder of the bill makes some changes to laws that are already on the books related to how greenhouse gas emissions are reported to the Department of Environmental Quality. And the intent of those changes is to ensure that, although the department is already gathering this information, just making clear in statute that the information needs to be available to them in a way that actually supports their implementation of the cap and investment program. And sections 21 through 32 of the bill change the name of the Oregon Global Warming Commission to the Commission on Climate Change. And the remaining provisions of the bill are conforming amendments and technical provisions to the operative dates. And just talking about those operative dates to reiterate, the cap and investment program would be set to become operative January 1, 2020.
Thank you very much. That was a very thorough explanation, Maureen, so thank you so much for that. Senator Olson.
Thank you very much. I guess I'd call you Chair Edwards, because you are Chair Edwards, or Senator Edwards. This bill is interesting. The one thing I haven't seen or heard of is, what does it cost? $34.70 was going to be about $250 million, according to, at $12 a ton. The Oregon Global Warming Commission wanted $60 a ton in their presentation, which would make it cost about $1.25 billion. So what do you anticipate, both this bill, what do you anticipate it's going to cost Oregonians?
Well, I think, Madam Chair, what it is going to cost an individual Oregonian would depend upon where their source of power is, and if you lived in a utility area that where you don't have, there's not much coal or gas in your utility portfolio, then you're probably not going to see much cost on your utility bill. If you do live in a coal-intensive utility area, then definitely there would be a cost, and that cost would be accompanied by rate relief programs. So that's the concept. We don't have the financial analysis done yet. There was a white paper that was done on the underlying concepts in this bill, but I believe it needs to be updated to the actual language of the bill. And that white paper was not done by me, but it was done by somebody that's been following the development of the bill. So I would put that in the category of information to get by February, and it is on the short list of things that I continue to work on, and I certainly want to understand really well as well.
Follow up. So we heard prior to your testimony that we have a Renew Oregon, an agreement on energy, and it's pretty certain that rates are going to go up for PG and PacifiCorp. This is a tax on that tax, so it's going to impact we, the ratepayers, and PacifiCorp PGE twice with two new price increases. But I will get very specific. We have I want to clarify this. You said that only companies that emit 25,000 metric tons a year or more will be impacted by this. Well, you know that OHSU does.
Mm-hmm.
So how is this going to how is this going to impact the costs of their medical facility when you go in there, if you need to go there? How is that going to impact your medical bill if they're paying higher costs for this cap and trade?
So. You said a lot of things there that I want to respond to.
Okay.
First, I reject the notion that it's a tax on a tax. So I just want, and secondly, that would presume that both bills passed. Okay. Thirdly, for an entity like OHSU, you would look at what their total emissions are and what the market price is, and that would be what they would be required to buy allowances for, or they can make reductions. You know, and I don't know what the nature of the emissions are, and that's one of the beauties of the market mechanism, is that it ensures the lowest possible cost of compliance. And so there's a lot of flexibility in the program. And one of the things, as we move forward with the debate on both this bill and the bill that we heard prior, that I'm looking for is a comparative analysis to a ratepayer. Now, if you're a ratepayer in Pacific Corp territory or PGE territory, what is the previous bill that we heard? What does that look like to you? Not just in the near term, but also in the out years in 2035, 2040, and versus what this approach might look like. And so I'm reserving judgment on the previous bill. I haven't jumped into the pool yet on that one yet, but that's part of the analysis that I want to see.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So thank you for all this hard work. It's amazing how complicated this stuff is. And I was reminded of that this morning as we met and went over the Betsy program. And we all looked back at, I guess it was 2007. I wasn't here yet. I came in 08. And then I've been helping with a broom and dustpan ever since to try to clean up the mess. And
we thank you for your
I appreciate your enthusiasm for my efforts, but I don't want to have to do it again. And so as I look at what you're doing here, I see Betsy times God knows, and this though, although we all share enthusiasm for doing something about CO2, and I mean it, we all do, the question is that we do it right. And I don't know if I mentioned my climate metrics bill.
I took a note.
So that bill would, were it adopted, had it been adopted in the last session, would have supplied us with a method of seeing perhaps how much this thing would cost us. But we don't have it yet. But what I do know, when you're seeking some foundation of reality to address these good thoughts that are in this bill, that we need to take the time to do it right, or we'll be spending enormous amount of time after the fact trying to fix it. So why we would hurry into it and then throw it on the doorstep of the DEQ is unclear to me. The suggestion that you've given that, well, why we need to hurry doesn't carry much weight with me because of the past experience that I've enjoyed here with the Betsy. I have great faith in this process. This, like we're doing right here, the hard work of the legislature. And this deserves that kind of attention, not something put together in a hurry, not when matters are so important. So I don't want you to rehash what you already told us about the speed, so please don't. I'm just asking, 017 is only a year away. I strongly recommend that we slow down and give this thing the attention it truly deserves. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question actually for Council and also one for Senator Edwards. For the Legislative Council, looking through the language on this bill and comparing it with legislation in California, it appears to be very similar, in some places almost verbatim. So I wonder, could you tell us how, in what material way this bill differs from the California Cap and Trade Bill?
It doesn't differ in many, Chair Vega Peterson, Senator Winsett. It doesn't differ in, I'm not sure that I can point out exactly how it differs materially from the California program. What I will say is that the legislation for the California program was incredibly broad. It allowed for the California Air Resources Board to adopt a cap and trade program, but set very, very, very few sideboards in place for how that program was going to be developed. And then the program was extensively developed in rule and very, very, very extensive, complicated rules. What this bill does is provide some more specificity and sideboards to how the program would be developed in statute, but still allows for a robust rulemaking process, understanding how complicated these markets are.
Thank you, Maria. Senator Edwards, it's my understanding that Oregon currently emits about 0.004% of the global greenhouse gas emissions. That's 4/10,000ths or 1 part in 2,500. So if we entirely depopulated the state of Oregon, it would not be measurable. The effect would not be measurable on a global statute. And we already are a national leader perennially in unemployment and poverty and so forth. So we have three programs here: cap and trade, low carbon fuel standard, and this renewable Oregon investor-owned utility massive increase in the RPS. My questions are, will these three projects be stacked together first? And if they are, who is going to determine the cumulative costs of, on transportation and utilities and industrial sectors of the three bills or the three different schemes? And who is determining the cumulative greenhouse gas reductions of the three, and how will they dovetail together to reach these pre-1990 levels?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that's a good question. I would not presume that all the programs will be stacked on top of one another. That is a decision for the 2016 Legislative Assembly. As I said to Senator Olson, I'm not presuming that the bill that we heard previously is going to pass. I also don't presume that this is going to pass. One of them might pass, both of them might pass. I mean, we're having today so that both committees understand what's out there and what's in play. I didn't work on the previous concept, although there were people that worked on the previous concept that worked on this one as well. And to the prelude to your question about Oregon's share, I mean, I would say if all nations, if all states, if all provinces took that approach, which they have so far, we wouldn't be getting very far on addressing climate change. And we're not on pace to do what we need to do. And that's part of the problem. That's why we're doing this. And I believe that the implementation of this type of a program would be meaningful for the state of Oregon in ensuring that we're doing our part. And us doing our part is politically meaningful vis-a-vis our role in on the West Coast. And from California to British Columbia, it is the fifth largest economy in the world. And if other regions of the United States or other regions of the world and the leadership of our great nation can point to at least a region that is doing something, I do think that it helps build momentum. And when states and regions are leading and the sky is in fact not falling, and I truly don't believe that the sky is going to fall, and I know that there is a difference of an opinion about those type of things, but you know, I just don't. And I think that there are a lot of really good infrastructure pieces to this bill that help create that resilience for Oregon. Then I think that it becomes something that other regions can look at and say, well, you know, it would be nice to do the right thing, you know, by the environment. And you know what? It's not all bad, and there are opportunities. So,
thank you for sharing that perspective. If the three, we know the low carbon fuel standard is, if you could address the issue, if all three passed, is there some, or do you contemplate some body, some individual, some process where the effects, the cumulative effects of all three would be addressed, would be measured, and would be made public in the event that all three of the projects became law?
I think, Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I think that that is, I think that our committees this February need to answer that question. I am not presuming as chair of our committee in the Senate, although I will point out that the bill that we just heard previously isn't necessarily going to the Senate Environment Natural Resources Committee. If it doesn't have a fiscal, it could end up in the Senate Business and Transportation Committee. which is chaired by the former PUC chairman. There's a lot of PUC stuff in that bill, so I'm just throwing that out there. And the chair of that committee is also co-chief sponsoring this legislation with me, and we'll be very mindful of any layering effects. And in fact, exhibit one on mindfulness of the layering effects is the delay in bringing transportation fuels into this program until the low carbon fuel standards, clean fuels objectives are met, the 10-year objectives are met. And that was intentional. So I think this public process that we're going to going through will bring out potential costs. And I know from historical precedent that my good Senate committee members, particularly Senator Olson and you, Senator Whitsitt, will make sure that we all know about the potential costs.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think we're all reeling is the right word. Maybe that is a good word, kind of just from the cumulative effect of the stuff that's kind of coming at us today. But I guess what takes me back a bit is that it was my understanding, and I could be wrong, but that the agreement that the investor owns and the environmental community worked on and negotiated and so forth would absolve that portion, i.e. the electrical grid, from being included in any subsequent legislation that would be coming forward at us this next session. But I see that that's not the case, because you clearly have them included in here. No. Obviously you weren't a part of that, I guess, so that's not, I'm not saying that we're right or wrong, but I guess my question would be is, as we begin the process of comparing and contrasting the two pieces of legislation that we've had presented today, it seems to me that the previous bill at least has a little bit cleaner pathway forward, i.e. it's a leap forward on the RPS, coal to clean happens, and it happens in a negotiated fashion. We don't have to create this incredibly burdensome and complicated bureaucracy to monitor, to enforce, to redistribute, to re-whatever. It just seems to me that if we're trying to make progress as a state, that that might be a better pathway forward to actually talk to the various entities, i.e. the transportation sector, talk to the electrical transportation generation sector. What could we arrive at? But this is a lot, and I think getting back to Representative Bence's comments about DEQ, our various agencies, and seeing what's happened with fairly small and limited projects in the past, and this is like that on steroids, and that gives me pause to even say, how in the world can we even wrap our minds around this in February? Because, agree, we're going to fire that starting pistol on Monday. By Friday, we've got to have posted whatever bills are going to be alive, and that's not a lot of time to be able to hear from all the different components and moving parts in something like this. So I don't really have a question necessarily in there, but I hope you hear the angst from me, and I think there's other members up here that feel that same burden too. We're drinking from the fire hose on this topic right now, and it's going to be really hard to do good work in a very short period of time.
Thank you. So Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator, I want to thank you for all your hard work on this. I know what a thorough job you've been doing at this, and it's a good task. But I just have a question, somewhat about all the work that's already gone into this. I know that this bill is looking at a lot of work and a program that's has been mentioned. Has already been up and running in California, and this legislature and the House committee has already looked at this particular proposal, not this specific one, but generally, House Bill 3470 last session, and moved it out of committee, and did hear from California and, you know, what it takes for them to manage the program. So I guess my question, so I know there's been a lot of work that's gone into it, a lot of discussion that's gone into it, and I know There's been conversations with the Department of Environmental Quality, even last session, on this proposal, and conversations with the state of California and how this bill would align and how would we would participate in potentially with their markets. And so when I'm looking at all that work, it seems like, not to coin a phrase, but, we're not totally reinventing the wheel here, and that we've been able to look at California's program and see where they have made some missteps but have now corrected many of those and, in fact, have looked at economic impacts of this program in California. And it, as I recall, it's been pretty positive on the amount of reinvestment that goes back into clean energy businesses and economies throughout their state. And so in light of that, do you know, have you had continuing conversations with the Department of Environmental Quality or the state of California folks in further refining this?
Madam Chair, Representative Holvey, yes and yes. The intent of this legislation is to be specific enough for legislative comfort, to create legislative comfort, although I'm not convinced that on this particular topic any level of specificity will ever bring total legislative comfort. But having said that, that the objective is to be specific enough so that we know enough about what it is that we're asking the department and the Environmental Quality Commission to do, but broad enough that we haven't boxed them into doing something that's just unworkable. And that is why I've been insistent with stakeholders that the department have enough time to develop all the rules of implementation so that we can look at those in 2019. There were a number of folks that really pushed hard to pass this bill in 2016 for 2018 implementation. And if you just, like, if you back up and you look at the calendar, it's just not realistic with the public rulemaking process and the stakeholder advisory group process to be able to do that on that timeline. And I want the legislature to be able to know what's happening prior to implementation of the program, which is why we're here in 2016. If we don't do anything until 2017, and then it'll be fall. I mean, realistically, the legislature gets done in by July of 2017. It'll be fall before stakeholder advisory committee can convene, and if it goes anything like testimony on the last bill, it's going to be Halloween-ish, early November before meetings start happening, and then you're into 2018. You can't get it done by the 2019 legislative session. You can't. It is impossible to have that level of rulemaking done. So really, then you're kicking it out another 2 years, and for the reasons for the climate reasons, for the early action reasons, for the potential benefits for early action, and for a number of reasons like that, I think it's time to do this now. But I'm very sensitive to some of the concerns raised about comfort with what it is that we're doing.
Follow up, Madam Chair, just real brief.
Follow up.
So just to clarify that, even if we were to pass this bill, we'd be coming back in 2019 to either adjust or eliminate or stop or change the program if we were to identify, problems that we saw coming or the agency saw coming or other information we might learn between now and 2019.
The bill as written does not require affirmative action on the part of the legislature to institute the program after the rules have been written and adopted, but it would give the legislature a chance informed by stakeholders, and we all know that we will hear from all of the stakeholders throughout this process to know what's going on. And if there are problems, to be able to intervene and say, well, stop the train. Like, we've heard a lot of discomfort about this particular thing, or we think you got it screwed up on this particular part. Or it could be the agency coming back and saying, look, all the stakeholders want to do this, but the bill is written, the statute is written, doesn't really allow us to do this. So could you give us some enabling legislation in 2019?
Okay. So we have time for one more question, and then we're going to take a five-minute recess and split back up into the two separate committees. So Senator Pryzlanski, you have the last question.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So Senator Edwards, I guess I've been listening to all this. I'm trying to sort this out. My understanding of what I'm going to take away from your presentation and the one we had before, the Oregon Climate Act of 2016 actually is looking at all of the areas of greenhouse gas emissions, the three different areas, as you mentioned, transportation fuels, electric power generation, as well as industrial emissions, and how can we actually capture all that. So would it be fair to first say that this would be kind of what we might call the umbrella bill or act that would take care of all three of those? With that in mind, that the RPS that we heard before is just one component of that, because my understanding, it's only going to be dealing with the area that's dealing with electric power generation. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, mostly. So it is fair to say that this is an umbrella policy. It is also fair to say that the build out of renewables would help. There is complementary. Build out of renewables is complementary with utilities' goal to, or objective to, lower the carbon intensity of their operations. So they are not mutually exclusive. And in fact, the state of California, when they had their enabling legislation, AB 32, which was mentioned earlier, which was much more broad, and said, agencies go out and do good things, develop a plan, and do stuff. It was a lot of parallel efforts. And they did take the low carbon fuel standard and layer it with a cap on emissions in the sector. We're doing what we think is tenable for the climate here in Oregon. And that's I guess my perspective on that.
Madam Chair, just to follow up, if I could, please. Thank you. So, and it's my understanding again, what you've laid out for this for these two committees is really an approach that's, let's say, better than what California did, because it will, in fact, allow, as Representative Hovey said, an opportunity once they've gone out there, once they've done their field work, once they've had the input from everyone, and they've put something together. We, the legislature, will have that opportunity to make any adjustments that we feel that are necessary. Not that we have to give them final approval, as you mentioned, but it does, in fact, give us that opportunity to hit the pause button to make certain, as compared to having to react after something's been actually implemented. Is that a fair statement?
That's a very fair statement, a very accurate statement from my perspective, and that is. Well, that's why, in fact, we drafted it this way. And I would like to, in closing, Madam Chair, thank all the folks that helped me draft this. There were a lot of folks behind the scenes, put in hundreds of hours, not the least of which is sitting next to me, our good drafter, Maureen McGee from Legislative Council. She's really done good work and helped bring actual, tangible language to lists of principles and minimums and all those sideboards and everything that a lot of stakeholders have put into this bill. And now we're ready to open up, that conversation to the entire stakeholder community in Oregon and see if we can't get something done. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Maureen, very much. Okay, with that, we're going to have a brief recess as we split. House members will be staying here because there's more of us, and the Senate committee will be going into hearing room B. With that, we have a five-minute recess. continue the informational meeting of the House Interim Energy and Environment Committee with an overview of the Oregon Global Warming Commission's 2015 report to the legislature. Welcome, Duncan.
Madam Chair, my name is Angus Duncan. I am chair of the Oregon Global Warming Commission, and I am told that I have, you know, far fewer minutes, but that's usual in this venue, isn't it? So I'm not trying to think of myself as this is the undercard, but I did wear my Rick Santorum vest sweater just to kind of feel like we're all fitting in here. And even though the audience has gotten smaller, the quality clearly has bumped up. All right.
That's playing to the crowd.
Yes, exactly. They're all out of here, aren't they? Yeah, good. Okay. So I have to zip through this. You've got one of these. I hope you appreciate the fact that this says September legislative days. This from last year. We're just recycling it for you so that we don't waste paper. Okay. And that's that. Moving right along. So this is, you just have to set stage here. These are Oregon's emissions through 2014. And the particularly interesting thing about this is sort of twofold, so I've marked it. One is we are actually within conversational distance of, you know, our 1990 greenhouse gas emissions in this state. We are not on track to meet our 2020 goals, as prior folks acknowledged. But it's not because we haven't been working, and it's not because the programs that we have put in place haven't been delivering. We just have to up the ante on those programs and on our efforts if we're going to get on our track. The other interesting thing is that we peaked in 1999. You know, we've been going basically either sideways or downwards ever since then, and that's especially interesting when you take a look at the national numbers, because the national numbers didn't peak till 2008. They have actually gone down fairly significantly since then, although, you know, we have to believe that a fairly significant chunk of that is the shaded area, which is recession. And recession is bad for people, but it's pretty good for pushing greenhouse gases down. It's just that recessions, happily, don't last forever, and so we have to go back and resort to our own methods. So this is the slide you saw earlier. These are our historical emissions. This is the trajectory we would have to be on if we were going to meet our 2050 greenhouse gas reduction goals. This is more like the trajectory that we are on. Our business as usual trajectory is that red line. And as you see, that essentially goes sideways. It means we are reducing emissions in some areas, but we've got more people, and people have more appetites, and so those effects end up countering each other out, and we don't make more progress unless we redouble our efforts. The other interesting thing about these slides is, I just want to note, is that, you know, these reductions that we've achieved so far are a function of the state's renewable portfolio standard, of the decision by PGE, the negotiated settlement decision to end coal combustion at Boardman in 2020. The clean fuels system, our commitment to energy efficiency, all of those are the things that have pushed emissions down in the face of economic and other demographic pressures to push them up. The other thing those reductions have done that is not always apparent is that they have essentially put Oregon in a position where it is one of three or four states in the country that is already going to be in compliance with EPA's Clean Power Plan in 2030. When we project out to 2030, Oregon's in compliance, and we have what we call headroom to spare. Washington's in compliance for many of the same reasons, but most of the states are not, because most of the states haven't made the commitments to energy efficiency, renewables, and reducing greenhouse gases across the board. This also means we avoid costs that other states are going to have to deal with to comply with the Clean Power Plan. It means we avoid some of the potential disruptions that a significant hit to our power system, you know, would impose on us. And it's because we've done our work. So, question, what measures or policies do we now have to resort to fill the remaining gap. And up to now, this commission and the state generally, we've had to rely on what I would characterize generously as informed judgment to come up with the ideas and to try to quantify them. You know, in the last 3 or 4 years, we, the commission, working with state agencies and others, have done a pretty dedicated effort to try to develop data on which you can base policies and choices. And at least in some areas, we've made some significant progress. Happily, since I'm not qualified to walk you through those data and analyses, I brought someone along with me who is. You're familiar with Jessica Shipley from the Oregon Department of Energy, and I asked Jessica to walk you through the analysis, the wedge analysis that we did for the 2015 report to the legislature.
Okay. So, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Shipley with Oregon Department of Energy. One of my roles at ODO is to provide technical assistance to the Oregon Global Warming Commission. So as Angus mentioned, to do this wedge-style analysis, we first looked at sort of existing information that was available to the state on these measures that could be implemented in the various sectors. And then after we added all those measures up, if we still hadn't sort of completely closed the gap between our projected emissions and our goal trajectory, we looked at what a carbon price could do to help close the rest of the gap. And so we're sort of referring to this as what's called a wedge analysis. It's built up sector by sector with these measures that help us close that gap between where we're headed and where we want to be headed. It's just one possible of many pathways that you could use to reduce emissions. It's not meant to be prescriptive, but rather illustrative of the different types of choices that we could make. And in the interest of time today, we're only going to talk about in detail two of the wedges, which you'll see on the next few slides. But all of the wedges are detailed in the extra slides and also, of course, in much more detail in the report. So the first sector we looked at was energy efficiency from the residential, commercial, and industrial sectors. So this wedge, along with all of the other wedges, include some pretty ambitious assumptions about technology deployment. In the case of this wedge, we're relying only on existing technology, so energy efficiency technologies that we're aware of today, and then aggressively deploying those. An example is something like residential HVAC and weatherization and lighting, but there's many, many other examples included in this wedge. We assume that this was done first because this is one of the most cost-effective ways to reduce emissions from the power sector. So we're going to jump ahead to the very last wedge, but there's lots of other measures included in this wedge analysis in the transportation sector, in materials and waste management. So just to say that we're just jumping ahead here in the interest of time. And the final wedge that was added was the addition of a carbon price, which we did because, as you can see, hopefully from this slide, that after all of the measure wedges were added, we didn't quite close the gap between our projected emissions and our target goal. So we worked with the same Portland State University researchers who did the carbon tax study for the legislature last year and asked them to run some scenarios to help us fill in this final piece of the gap with a carbon price. In this particular case, it starts at $10 a ton and ramps up $10 per year to $60 a ton and stays there for the rest of the time period. So you can see the outcome of that modeling in this slide. And so just putting it all back together, this, again, we're really rushing through this a bit. So this kind of concludes the analysis that was presented to you in the 2015 report. So I'm going to hand it back over to Angus to talk about conclusions and next steps.
So to some extent, this wedge analysis is intended to try to address the comment Representative Johnson made about drinking from a fire hose, although in the shortened period we're going to have to turn up the velocity of the water coming out of the fire hose here. But I want to try to fit these pieces together so that they have some coherence for people. So the first thing I think to say is, if you've got a combination of programmatic measures and you've got a cap or a tax, and they're each serving somewhat different functions, but they complement each other. They don't, if they're constructed correctly, they don't duplicate each other. The programmatic measures, in many cases, are the least cost, most direct path when you have a large emitter or a body of large emitters where you can fashion the programmatic measures so they fit those large emitters. And the coal to renewables compromise that you heard earlier today was a real effort to try to systematically do that, to fit the pieces together so you get the greatest emissions reduction and you get the least cost in disruption. And those work well with something like a large utility or a large industrial plant. They don't work particularly well for what we would call non-point source pollutions. That's mostly you and me. You know, it's an individual driving a car. It's harder to do a programmatic regulation of them, but they can respond to the kind of broad sweep of a cap or a tax, and that's frequently the most cost-effective and cost-efficient way of getting the emissions out of an area like especially diffuse transportation. So they really work together. I would just add one other quick comment about the wedge analysis. And you know, one of the advantages of being able to look at this is that you see, for example, that in order to get on our trajectory, we don't necessarily have to ramp a carbon tax or cap in as fast as this suggests. You know, we could ramp it in more slowly. We could avoid that bellying out below the line, as it were, and push some of those costs further out. But it's an advantage to a cap or a tax that you can shape it to the needs and the emission sources over time. And now I'm going to whip through the last of this. I understand I've got sort of two more areas I want to talk a little bit about. One is to drill down into those emissions and say how we're trying to address them. So here's a rough breakout of, you know, where Oregon's emissions come from. And the really important takeaway from this is that light-duty vehicles, cars and small trucks, are about 25% of our greenhouse gas emissions in the state. Just the emissions associated with the coal plants are another 25% of our greenhouse gas emissions. So those are two very large discrete chunks. If you can focus your program, either your programmatic measures or your cap and tax on those, yeah, you get the biggest bang for the buck. And mind you, we're not talking about reducing the number of cars. We're talking about increasing the efficiency of the cars. We're not talking about necessarily reducing generation below that necessary to serve load. We're talking about increasing the carbon efficiency of the generation. So we did take a look at where the utilities were without this allowance without the coal to renewables analysis. And essentially, that's what you see there. You see the two utilities emissions basically going sideways for the foreseeable future and being substantially distant from their proportionate share, as it were, of the state's greenhouse gas goals. And this is important for utilities. But as it turns out, it's also really important for the transportation sector. And the reason for that is also the reason why we put electric vehicles into that agreement, that based on the analysis done by ODOT, in which I participated, we have to achieve a substantially almost complete switchover of our light-duty vehicle fleet from internal combustion engines to electric vehicles or something comparable to them in emissions. And by comparable, I mean plugging those cars not into the side of coal plants, but into the sides of a high carbon efficiency, therefore a low carbon power system. You have to have the two pieces together. And I did a little bit of analysis of this. I went and figured out approximately what the carbon equivalent was of plugging an electric vehicle into a socket in Wichita, in Raleigh, and in Seattle. And you can see, you know, it's actually not bad when you plug it into a coal plant because you're still getting about 35 miles to the gallon, but you can do, or the carbon equivalent of that. But you could still do way, way better than that. And if you plugged it into Raleigh, which has much less coal, if you plugged it into Seattle, even better. Well, Pacific Core right now is roughly equivalent to where Wichita, Kansas is. So you don't get the EV bang for the buck when you plug it into a utility that is so coal-dependent. PGE, more like Raleigh, North Carolina, you're getting a much better deal there, but you can still get internal combustion engines that do better than 55 miles to the gallon. Plug it into EWEB, it's like plugging it into Seattle. So to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in both transportation and in utilities, you know, we have to push the amount of coal down, and we have to avoid replacing all that baseload coal with baseload gas. So this is just a reprise of, I think, what you've already heard, but this is a little bit my take on it. And I have to qualify this by noting that I participated in these negotiations, but not as the chair of the Global Warming Commission. I also represent the Northwest, or the Natural Resources Defense Council in the Pacific Northwest, and that's the hat I was wearing there. But then I'm analyzing, using my Oregon Global Warming Commission hat. If you can keep track of that, all you're doing better than I am. The important parts of it are not necessarily so much backing out coal, because as Representative Dent said, Pacific Power can redispatch that coal to other loads. So it's a modest pushback on coal, and it is additive to the push down on coal that the Clean Power Plan is creating, and a series of other Clean Air Act pressures are creating. So it's additive to that, but I can't claim, and I won't claim, that it is reducing any coal plant greenhouse gas emissions at all. What it is doing by introducing substantial additional renewables is it is precluding the probability that our two electric utilities will make substantial investments in new baseload gas plants, investments that carry fuel cost risk, investments that carry significant regulatory risk, and we will be investing instead in a much cleaner combination of wind, solar, with gas performing a really essential function here, but the essential function is integrating those variable resources. And if we do those sorts of things, then we end up with, at least in the utility sector, a line that looks approximately like this. And this is my analysis. I've double-checked it in some cases. I've double-checked it with PGE. We're still working on Pacific. We're still working with ODO and the PUC on it. So I've tried to develop this as a very conservative set of numbers. And even on a very conservative basis, you can see that emissions are still going down in this sector between now and 2030, but that in 2030 they drop like a stone. And they drop that way because that's when the Pacific Power coal, the most part of the Pacific Power coal fleet, drops out of service to Oregon, and we expect PGE's share of coal strip to also probably drop out in 2030. And they stay below their share of the goal through 2035, although the other interesting takeaway here is they start to come back together again. So you're not done with this when you take this kind of action. The other thing I want to make sure I mention here, because it goes to a question from the earlier session, is that we would expect that if this is done and if there were a carbon cap, that the two electric utilities and most and probably all of the consumer-owned utilities would essentially be in compliance with that cap at least through 2035. And it's relatively easy to layer these regulations together. We do it all the time. We layer the analyses together. So this, for example, includes numbers from the two utility IRPs, you know, layered together and then matched up against the projected greenhouse gas emissions. That's all I'm going to say on that. One last pitch here. So this is the Oregon Global Warming Commission, and you know, every year when I come in to do these reports, or I guess every other year, I give you that At this point, fairly tired joke about how you gave us lots of responsibility, no authority, no budget, and I don't want to say no staff because Jessica is still back there somewhere. But we get staff when the agencies don't have a prior use for them. And our responsibilities, well, here are some of them that you put in the bill. Oh, here are a few more. I didn't include all of these because I figured we wouldn't have time. But I do want to make the point. And the point is that, frankly, and actually several of Representative Benson's comments have gone to this as well, we do not have a well-functioning climate policy or apparatus in this state. You know, we are frequently flying, if not blind, then at least by the seat of our pants. We don't have the kind of analysis, and we don't have the tools to do a careful look at what the consequences of the policy questions will be that you're being asked to make, let alone the ones you've already made. The commission is unable to do that. We are unable to compel the agencies to do it. We're unable to negotiate with the agencies an allocation of their share of the responsibilities under the commission's roadmap. We can't negotiate benchmarks with them, and if you can't negotiate benchmarks, you have no way to measure progress or its failure. And I think, Senator Vance, just in case you weren't going to get a chance to make reference to your climate metrics bill, I will, because believe me, it is a gap that I feel at least as intensely as you do. So. Chair Vega Peterson, you know, I realize that anytime someone brings a government reorganization idea to the legislature, it goes right to the bottom of everybody's pile, right? Because it's not policy. But right now, you have a broken climate policy making and implementing mechanism in the state, and it really needs some attention. And I have some specific ideas, which I'm going to spare you this afternoon. But I am hoping we will have a chance to talk about those and that somebody somewhere on this esteemable panel will decide that we really need to go back, revisit that 2007 Act, and make it work. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Angus. And I think you saved us a question with your metrics thing. And unfortunately, we don't have time for questions unless somebody has really brief, because we do have to hear about the legislative concepts for February.
And I can stick around.
Okay, thank you.
Very close. And this has. Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is related to my legislative concept. We have the expert here, so I want to ask about black carbon.
Yes.
And in our most recent report. You discuss black carbon a little bit. The question is, can you help me and the committee understand how similar black carbon is to greenhouse gases in climate change effects, so that I know that question is going to come up in a minute.
So in the best spirit of candidate forums, let me just springboard off of that to say our agenda in 2016 is forest carbon accounting, black carbon, adaptation, transportation carbon, transportation finance, distributed cost effects of carbon policies, and the list goes on. So we're going to try to do all of these, including black carbon. And the answer to your question about black carbon is, as far as we're concerned, it is a greenhouse gas. It functions somewhat differently from the usual greenhouse gases, but it is a greenhouse gas. It needs quantifying. We need to identify more clearly what the sources of it are and figure out what are the most cost-effective ways to get at reducing it. Representative Helm, I've had a chance to look at your bill. I am very much in favor of us adding black carbon specifically, although I will tell you my commission will look at it, you know, whether or not you tell us, you know, we should. But I think you should tell us we should, because that's really your responsibility. And in particular, with respect to black carbon in the forest, we know that we are experiencing substantial increases in in the severity and in the extent of forest fires, and to the extent that those are out of the realm of customary historical, you know, fire operating in a forest ecosystem, we have to deal with those. The black carbon emitted in the course of those fires is only one, but probably the most important reason why we need to do that. Was that a succinct answer?
It was
relatively.
I think you can get. So, yes, thank you. So, all right. Thank you very much for
thank you,
this.
Madam Chair.
And I look forward to, I'm sure we'll be hearing from you more in the February session on all these different topics.
Oh, I hope so.
Yes, thank you.
Thank
okay,
you.
Thank you. Next, I'm going to call up, we're going to start talking about some of these other legislative concepts. Legislative Concept 212, David Brown from Obsidian Renewables, and this will be, should be familiar to committee members. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Brown. My company is Obsidian Renewables. You know me as a larger scale solar developer in the sunny parts of the state. Last session, we had House Bill 2632, which was very popular, but ran aground with the fiscal at the end of session and the difficult job of the Ways and Means Committee to make hard choices about what the state can and can't afford. I was asked to come back with a bill that was scaled down as much as possible, and that's what this legislative concept 212 is about. I'm sure I'll be back the first week of February and I'll talk more about the bill then, but I just want to frame it for you today. Last bill, the cost was 2 cents a kilowatt hour. This is half a cent a kilowatt hour. Last bill was 7 years. This is 5 years. Last bill was for as much as 450 megawatts. This is down to 150. Cumulative, all of that has reduced the estimated fiscal cost, as I've calculated for this bill, to $5.7 million over 5 years. And this would result in somewhere between 100 and 150 megawatts of projects being built in the next 15 to 18 months. These are projects that are shovel-ready, but just real tight on the economics, and it comes down to the value of the REC. What I've done with this bill, instead of having the state buy that green tag, it's up to the developer to sell it, but the state is supporting the price of that green tag by one half of a penny per kilowatt hour to try to give that enough confidence to developers to go ahead and finish the projects. I have posted testimony. I'm not going to go through it in detail, but it does identify and that I expect for every dollar of state support over the 30-year life of the project, you'll receive $5.50 in property taxes, $14 in income tax, state income taxes, $17.50 in federal tax credits, and $57 in construction labor. We're talking about 400 full-time jobs to get these projects done on a full-time equivalency basis. It's very exciting. Also, in conclusion, I want to say that the next project that we'll be announcing, the Black Cap 2 solar project in Lakeview, which will be selling its power to Pacific Power, and at the time it's announced, it'll be Oregon's largest, but there are several projects approximately that size that would be included if this bill passes. That project is very proud to announce today that it has selected Solar World panels. It's the first utility-scale project in Oregon using Solar World panels. Solar World has expanded, as you all know. They're now building a bigger panel, which is perfect for utility-sized projects. I can confirm with enthusiasm that Solar World has an outstanding, well-earned reputation for quality, and I just couldn't be happier specifying their panels for the next project. Thank you.
Thank you. Wonderful. Questions? Thank you. We look forward to seeing you first week of February.
Thank you very much, Chair Peterson.
Okay. So, members, Representative Boone, I believe you had a concept.
I do. Yes.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay. So,
Representative.
Yeah. Oh, and so just.
Nope, I don't need that.
You can.
That's for you.
Yeah. You can wait. She'll go, and then you can go down there.
Oh. I did not.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. And you know, if I'm sitting here, it's got to have to do with ocean energy in this committee. This is a bill that I was approached by Oregon State University and the Nemrec Center, Dr. Belinda Batten and Jock Mills with OSU. They had a little gift dropped down from the sky in the form of some federal money from Department of Energy for the first time, actually solid and not just running on a continuing resolution. There's a large grant that's supposed to be spent on ocean energy projects. What it will do, it will pay for the Pacific Marine Energy Center, PMEC, and SETS, which is the South Energy Test Site, and that is a series of four or five berths. You will recall that last session in our committee, we had a presentation on this from Dr. Batten, just kind of updating us on the NEMRAC program and what they're doing. Our competition in this is California, and this is really hot competition. It's coming up fast. It's moving quickly, and what we need to do is the very first, this is over a six-year period about, the first phase is a $5 million grant to Oregon State to do this, to start to develop it. We have a 20% match requirement, cash match, so we're going to be needing the, and the bill calls for $1.25 million to be our skin in the game in this, and then the device developers will come to Oregon to test their devices in one of these berths. They lease or rent for, I don't know how much they cost, but it's a nice sum. And for the first time, thanks to this committee passing legislation a few sessions ago on allowing the energy produced by the devices in the test center to be utilized as energy, as power. This will power the I don't even know what we call it, the compound of NOAA and Marine Science Center down there in Newport. It's very important to Newport and the coast. It's centrally located. These devices will test in our waters. That the site has been chosen by a lot of stakeholders, fishermen, et cetera. And the piece in the bill that calls for $250,000 for OWET, which is basically the second year of their biennium funding, because they were only given half of their funding last year. So the fact that they are the go-to group to for a device developer and anything to do with ocean energy, they work very closely with the NEMRAC Center. So we are asking for your support in that. This will move quickly, hopefully, and I'm pretty much the Sherpa on it, and got a lot of support from the Oregon State University compound down there and Dr. Batten along with Jock Mills. So hope that if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them, but I hope that you will support this.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Helm? Would you mind if we have Representative Buckley here this evening? Would you mind letting him go? Representative Buckley, you may take the stage.
Now, these are personal bills, not committee bills. Is that correct?
Member bills? This is actually, so welcome, Representative Buckley. And you're going to be talking about two concepts or one concept?
I only have one concept right now.
That's great.
Because I think you've listened to enough today. you want my entire... thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Representative Peter Buckley representing South Jackson County in the Oregon House of Representatives. First of all, I just want to thank your committee for even considering introducing this bill. Yep. We didn't have a vehicle for it, and your chair has been kind enough to offer a committee introduction of it. The Ashland Cooperative Market, their board contacted me and just asked whether it would be possible for co-ops to do their board elections via online ballots. Mm-hmm. And we checked with Ledge Council, and Ledge Council said, we think they can.
And so they went back and searched. They said, well, it's a little unclear, so we might want to just specify in statute how the elections are, how members of a cooperative are notified of an election, and that it is possible to have a cooperative of any kind in the state hold their board elections via online. So I'll just read the statement that Mary Beth wrote out for me. LC 213 simply amends current relevant Oregon statutes to allow for shareholders in and members of cooperative corporations, co-ops, to vote by electronic means, including but not limited to email. Previously, shareholders in and members of co-ops could only vote in person or through a proxy that a shareholder or the duly authorized attorney in fact of the shareholder executed in writing. This measure expands this to allow for voting via email or other electronic methods. The bill also provides a definition of electronic means. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Buckley. And yes, to clarify for the committee, we're bringing Representative Buckley to the meeting, we did have Representative Boone talk about an individual bill, but both the bill that David talked about and Representative Buckley will be the committee bills that we're considering. Representative Johnson.
I just wanted to thank the representative for his legislative concept. To me, this embodies the type of legislation that the legislature should be considering in a very short February session. Concise, limited, finite in scope. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other
questions?
What about that? That's pretty easy.
All right. Thank you so much, Representative.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Helm.
Oh, okay. I didn't even get into the 500 students.
Welcome. And based on your last question, I don't think we'll be too shocked to hear what this is
about. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, for your record. Ken Helm, House Representative for District 34. This bill concept grew out of several different directions. One of them was conversations with some of the members of this committee informally about actions that we might take to reduce carbon that are different than some of the big and more complicated types of bills that we've heard today. Wildfire came up during those discussions. I think we all recognize that black carbon caused by unplanned wildfires has set outside of our global warming policies, and still does. And then we had the catastrophic fires this summer. And I've been listening since I came to the legislature very carefully to the folks that represent areas in the state that are dominated by forests and rangelands about this issue, and they raised the very valid question in my mind, well, we're focusing on types of actions that we can take that affect business to improve the state's ability to deal with climate change, but yet every summer we seem to have these catastrophic fires that pump who knows how many metric tons of black carbon, a greenhouse gas, into the atmosphere. I think that's a valid concern. And we need a vehicle to kind of get to it in some way. All this bill does is say black carbon, we need to treat it in the same way that we treat greenhouse gases from our climate policy point of view. It asks the Global Warming Commission to try to measure it, quantify it, and tell us what we can do about it. There's one section that picks up a piece of work that Representative Leininger and I did last session that passed both houses and stalled in Ways and Means, which was a direction to the Department of Land Conservation and Development to do natural hazards planning. There was a component of that bill that asked DLCD to provide guidance, not rulemaking, not mandatory binding rules, but guidance on how to mitigate wildfire risks outside UGBs. At that time, that language was agreed to by all the parties involved, including the home builders and the realtors, mm-hmm. et cetera.
at least we got to neutral with them, and the bill obviously made it through the process. I picked that up because it's related, and it can be done. Well, I hope that meets Representative Johnson's criteria for a short session bill.
It's close.
Can't wait to see your best. All right, thank you, Representative Helm. Any other questions? No, I think we're
very happy to have your input on it soon.
Thank you very much for going through that, for the handy sheet. Okay, are we
to close the information?
Yeah. Okay. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close our informational meeting for and open a work session to vote on the introduction of committee legislative concepts. And I'm sure for those of you who've already had committees this legislative day, as you've heard the important statement that voting on the concepts in no way indicate support or opposition to the bills in there. It is just really a technical thing to get the bills into the process so that we're able to have the discussion that's needed on them during the February session. And with that,
thanks.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Chair Vega Peterson, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 42, dated 1/14/16, LC 212, dated 12/15/15, and LC 213, dated 12/7/15.
Okay, Representative Johnson moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 42, dated 1/14/16, LC 212, dated 12/15/15, and LC 213, dated 12/7/15. Is there any discussion? Okay, is there any objection? Okay, hearing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. And with that, my colleagues, we are done with the House Energy and Environment Committee, unless anyone else has anything else for the good of the order.
Give me more, please.
Yes, I will. I'll give you more. And actually, there, I do have the one last thing, which is our committee time during the February session will be Tuesdays and Thursdays from 8 a.m. till 10 a.m. So.
Oi. Morning?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So.
That's good.
We will see you bright and early on Tuesdays and Thursdays. Yes.
Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Normally,
don't get up early.
8 to 10 a.m. Yes. All right, with that, I'm closing the hearing.
Can I hear?
Yes. Yes. I'm closing the hearing.